So let's take a moment to bring our minds to rest. And in that state of relaxed focus, we will do our prayers. Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer, 3x7-branch prayer to accumulate merit, mandala offering to accumulate merit, all of which empowers this session of study, contemplation, and meditation, and the request for teaching. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And everybody can just keep resting their mind while I do the teacher prayers, starting with the four Dharmas of Gampopa, and we can make this aspiration along with the words. Dadan sam chen tam che lo chu su drawers and ji love to soul. Chilam du drawers and ji love to soul. Lam trulpa sowers and ji love to soul. Trulpa yeshe su charwars and ji love to soul. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chen ke chulbum dadami ke nam dang droa kunji daki jitsam par tam che ke du daki chatento. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, our aspiration and how we're going to carry it out, including through this class. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So is the sound quality okay? Okay, good. I'm going to make Lama Jinsung a co-host in the hope that if we have a lot of discussion, she will be able to help me keep track of who wants to speak. And I'm hoping we will have a lot of discussion today. But first, this class will by no means cover comprehensively all of the material, just even in the book, let alone with the course added to that. And again, anybody's not taking the course, no problem. We'll be discussing it a little bit, but it relates quite directly to the book. So my idea is we're going to spend the first period, probably till around 2:30, doing meditations from the book, because there's a lot of meditation in this section, a lot of things we can work with as meditation, sort of contemplation and meditation together, my favorite. And then the second half hour could be a free-for-all. I'd like to focus in the second half hour on the book. And anybody, I certainly have a whole list of things that I could talk about, but I'd like to hear from other people, like what resonated with you in particular, and any experiences that you may have that relate to anything that Mingyur Rinpoche has said. And then I'd like to reserve approximately the last half hour to bring in like the dream practice as it described in the course, the Bardo of Dreams. And it may not play out exactly that way, but that's just my rough outline. So let's go. Anybody have anything that needs to be said before we do the meditation? Okay, so sort of staying in our resting and alert state of mind. We can check in with our posture, which we didn't do at the beginning, if you need to do that, because that helps the mind to settle, to have the posture in a straight but relaxed. Go ahead, Jinsong.
I'm not sure why I have you, me, and John Renish have a blinking light where recording is going on. Is it not recording, or does that mean it is recording? I've never seen that before on the participants.
You're seeing it because you're a co-host.
I'm sorry.
I think you're seeing the host screen now.
I see. Think. Okay, so, very good. And so when it's blinking, it's recording?
When it says it's recording, it's recording. John, do you have any clues that it's not recording?
No, if it's blinking and it means it's recording for, that'll tell myself and my children that we're recording.
Oh, I see.
The host, you're a co-host, so you're seeing that somebody's recording.
Okay. Some reason, I thought the recording was a single red light, so I thought maybe it was in pause mode or something.
No,
thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt. Okay.
No, that's not an interruption. Thanks. If we had not been recording, that would have been sad. So, okay. Anybody else? All right. So, within the state of straight and relaxed posture and settled mind within alertness and relaxation, I'm going to read some passages from the book that are specific meditations. And the first one, you don't need to look at your book, but starting on page 59, which is early in this section that we were given today. Is that right? Hold on. To 60. Okay, I'm not seeing it, but I must have written the page down wrong. Hold on. Okay, I have to sort this out. 63, 65. 59 to 60. Okay, it is 59. Okay, it must be the bottom. Okay, bottom of page 59. This is about using the breath. This relates really to the practice that he gave us in the course for the bardo of this life. But it's really helpful, and it also looks ahead to the next bardo, the bardo of meditation, because he's going to give a very similar method as our practice for that. So I'll just read and then we'll meditate as indicated. So again, letting the mind just come to rest, which we'll do progressively once we set the intention. We don't have to worry about whether it's settled or not. And we just don't get carried off by any thoughts or emotions or storylines that come into our head. We just come back if we do. So Mingyur Rinpoche says, it's the mind's habit to experience the transition between realms, and these by realms he means emotional states, he's just discussed that, or the transition between breaths or thoughts as uninterrupted. Yet with examination, we can learn that there's always a gap, a moment of space in between those things that we assume are continuous, just as there are for breaths and for thoughts. Even though we speak of continual nowness, some moments offer heightened opportunities to recognize the gap and experience a glimpse of emptiness. So here he's been talking about the gap and how there are gaps between everything. You know, as Marilyn likes to say, dying every second, there's gaps from second to second. And so we're learning, we're going to train in recognizing those gaps. And the reason that we do that is because it's easier to see emptiness, easier to see the nature of mind in the gaps. So we're training ourselves now to just be alert to gaps in our experience when we have this opportunity. So we're going to create one by using the breath as our support for meditation. So let's just start doing that, just noticing our breath coming and going as we always do with breathing meditation. Not breathing in any particular way, just letting the breath come and go naturally. Noticing the in-breath from start to finish, the out-breath from start to finish, and any pauses that may naturally occur in between. Mindy Rinpoche says, let's say that we take an in-breath. Every moment along the spectrum of breathing is another now moment. So during an in-breath, even an in-breath can be broken down into many, many discrete nows. And between each now, there is a transition, a bardo, a gap. Here with breathing, the gross gap is at the end of each in-breath, the end of each out-breath. But even within the in-breath and the out-breath, we could become aware of moment-to-moment reality, moment-to-moment change, moment-to-moment opportunity. And this is one of the manifestations of impermanence that Gampopa in Ornament of Precious Liberation encourages us to tune into. The gaps between seasons, which we're approaching one or we're in one now. The gaps between day and night. And the third one is what Mindy Rinpoche is talking about here. The gaps between moments, moment to moment impermanence. So we're just relaxing into awareness of the many moments, even within the duration of an in-breath and an out-breath. And as Mindy Rinpoche points out in the course, section one of the course, I forgot what I was going to say. So now he directs us to the moment that is right at the end of the inhalation. And I think also right at the end of the exhalation, because those are the really gross, the more pronounced transitions. In those moments intensify our sensitivity to change. Therefore, this moment, the gap at the end of the in-breath, the gap at the end of the out-breath, holds greater potential for accessing awareness of the gaps that are always there. So we may not be as aware of the moment-to-moment gaps, but we can definitely notice the gaps at the end of each inhalation and exhalation. And in those gaps, it's easiest to see emptiness, easiest to see the nature of mind. When Lama Norla Rinpoche taught taking and sending many years ago in Charlottesville, he suggested that when we do taking and sending, we can also incorporate meditation on ultimate reality right within it, meditation on the nature of mind, by at the end of each in-breath, the end of each out-breath, just taking a moment to rest in who is breathing, who is breathing in, who is breathing out, sort of a gentle inquiry. Just resting in it, not so much analyzing it, but just being aware of that question. And that brings us closer to recognition of the nature of mind, which Mingyur Rinpoche spends a lot of time in this section, pointing us to deconstructing our sense of identity of self. Who is breathing in? Who is breathing out? Is there a fixed identity that is breathing in and breathing out? Are we the same from moment to moment, from breath to breath? And what I was going to say before was that in the first section of Dying Every Day, Mingyur Rinpoche, the practice we were given by Mingyur Rinpoche is to notice all the change that's taking place as we breathe in and out, not only the gross changes of breathing itself, that you're breathing in oxygen, breathing out carbon dioxide, but all the changes that are occurring within our body during an in-breath, during an out-breath, even at the cellular level. And as we know, becoming aware of impermanence is the gateway to becoming aware of emptiness, to connecting directly with the nature of reality and of our own mind. So now we're going to just segue into another phase of meditation, which is on page 62 of the book. Oh, actually, at the beginning of begins on page 61. So this is as he is walking back into the train station. He says he's becoming aware of a creeping intuition that at any second I might become overwhelmed by too much newness or faint or flee like a spooked horse. I could see my mounting distress. I watched the anticipation as if watching lightning approach from across a valley. I acknowledged the discomfort in my body. I greeted these sensations with curiosity about what might happen next. So if there's anything, some small thing, or something that's just present at the moment, any kind of distress or uneasiness or anxiety, we could very gently tune into that. And if you're not comfortable with that, that's fine. Just continue to rest in awareness. And following Mingyur Rinpoche's example, how does it feel in our body? In fact, whether we have distress or not, how does it feel in our body right now? How do we feel? And that too is a practice he comes back to again and again in the book, turning his attention from whatever outward circumstances disturbing his mind to how do I feel right now? How does my body feel? How does my mind feel? We might notice moment-to-moment change in our experience as we rest in this awareness of what our body and our mind feel like in this moment. And we might greet whatever sensations are arising with curiosity about what might happen next. So again, just tuning in, not trying to change anything, not evaluating anything, just resting with it, with a sense of openness, receptivity, and curiosity about our experience. And he goes a little further into it on page 62, to be at home everywhere, which was his aspiration when he set out on retreat, meant not getting hooked by sights, sounds, and smells that attract and repel. It meant letting go of the impulse to pick and choose and allowing the objects I saw and smelled and heard to just be without going toward them, without withdrawing from them, just staying with the clarity of the awareness and allowing all the phenomena around me, whatever they might be, to drift by like clouds. So let's do that. Whatever we are noticing in our sensory field, any sensory impressions, visual, auditory, perhaps there is a smell or a taste or a tactile sensation, too hot, too cold, a breeze. Just tuning into it, letting it just be. We could notice even up to the point of pleasant or unpleasant, but we don't go further. We don't need to go further than that. We can catch ourselves and just stay tuned in at pleasant or unpleasant. And letting all our sensory impressions drift by like clouds. Again, noticing the moment-to-moment change, the ups and downs in our mental state, our emotional state, the feeling of our body. Just resting in the flow of our experience. And this is something we can do, especially out in the world when we become distressed by something or something gets our attention. Now I'm going to go to page 70 for the final phase of our meditation, and there's lots more meditation in the book. So he's wandering around the train station now. And he says, I now initiated the same type of scan that I had undertaken on the train. We did that one a couple of weeks ago. As a way to relax my body, or I tried to, going from the top of the head to the soles of the feet. After about 5 minutes, the effort shifted to feeling the changes within my body. So he's just scanning his body. And he could be relaxing, letting go of any tension, but he's also noticing changes in his experience, changes in how his body feels at each point that he focuses on. So he starts with, I brought my apparent awareness to my forehead. We can do the same. How does our forehead feel? Is there tension there? If we relax the tension consciously, do we feel a change? And we're not trying to make a change happen. We're just noticing. In his experience, he says, sitting quietly, I tried to feel any sensation there, perhaps heat, tingling, or vibration. Subtle sensation always exists, but I was too stressed out to detect it. So he doesn't feel any sensation because he's too distracted by what's happening around him and by his distress. So what he does is, after a minute or two, I brought my hand up to my head and kept the palm side about a quarter of an inch from my forehead, not touching. Then my palm could feel the heat that was coming from the inside and some tingling. So if you don't feel a sensation, you could try that. And then you might feel something from the interaction between your palm and your forehead or some other part of your body. He's just trying here to get in touch with his body because he's very much out of touch with it. I brought my hand down and returned my awareness to my forehead. I kept it there, the awareness, until I could feel a shift in sensation from heat to pressure to relaxation. So he's very patient. He's not rushing through this. It's not perfunctory. He waits until he feels a change. We won't do that today. But he describes the process he continues to go through. I stayed aware of this sensation, which always changes. Let it go. Let it be. However pleasant, don't hold on to it. I tried to rest in the experience of steady awareness. So he's not resting so much in the experience of what he's feeling, but he's resting in the awareness of what he's experiencing. Always coming back to awareness. Then, maintaining steady awareness, I moved my attention to the top of my head. The intention was to connect with any sensation. I felt tightness in my nerves, in my muscles, in my skin. My mind hovered above my head, twitching between past and future. So thoughts are trying to engage him. I brought my mind back into my head, into my body. Try to feel the sensations. So we could be feeling our entire body now. Tuning into the overall sensation of our body or sensation in any part of our body, just resting with it again. We could be feeling whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, but not spilling over into wishing for it to be different, wishing for it to stay like it is, or wishing for it to change from what it is, just resting with how it is. And again, keeping our attention really settled in the awareness of it. And he says, if I could not feel the sensation, then I tried to stay with that, the awareness of no sensation. So we don't have to dwell on whether there's sensation or not. We don't have to create sensation. We could just rest in whatever is arising, sensation or no sensation, pleasant or unpleasant. I moved down to the face, the jaw muscles, the mouth, the lips. Stay with whatever is happening, I told myself, and see if you can notice changes both in the sensation and in your reaction. Does the pleasant or unpleasant change? I needed to re-experience the continuity of change to remember that every moment holds a chance to transcend the fixed mind, the breeding ground for anxiety and stress. Between every breath and every thought, gaps exist utterly free of conception and memory, but our mental habits obscure this information. So we're we're working with our habitual patterns here, our habitual clinging to feelings and thoughts. And he's hinting here at what he's going to talk about a fair amount in this section, that the point of becoming aware of tuning into these gaps, the moment-to-moment gaps or the rougher gaps, the more obvious gaps between breaths, between, you know, shifts, between obvious shifts. The point is that each of these gaps is an opportunity to not engage in our habitual patterns, to not get caught up in thought, to not get caught up in emotion, to not get caught up in grasping and fixation. We can free ourselves in each moment, but to do that, we have to become aware of the gaps, of the transitions, of the bardos. So we'll just continue to rest for another minute. Just noticing the flow of our experience again. If we find ourselves getting caught by anything, we just let go, come back to just resting, noticing the changes. And this is a practice we can come back to again and again. It's certainly one of the core practices of the book, of the course, always staying in touch with impermanence, always staying in touch with our awareness of impermanence, our awareness, as opposed to getting completely caught up in our experience. And when we do get completely caught up, we can come back to Pema Chidren's instruction to feel our feet on the ground, feel the space around us. That's a way to come back to awareness while still resting with whatever it is we're experiencing. And we can do this not only as we sit in meditation, which is our training ground, but then we can take it with us out into any experience in our daily life. Anything we experience, we can also be in touch with our awareness, be in touch with that sense of everything changing moment to moment. We are not stuck in anything, not stuck in any experience or reaction. We can always come back to awareness and know that everything is changing. So we can come back now. And I'm going to open it up to anybody's input, any discussion, anything you'd like to share that resonated with you. And if nobody has anything, I've got plenty. John, I'm going to unmute you. Or you're going to unmute yourself.
So I was wondering, how practical is it to try to look for these subtle changes in your body, like the dying of the cells and things, when you can't actually perceive them? I mean, you can look for them, but mm-hmm. I don't know what's beyond that.
I think it's more just being aware that it's happening. I don't think it's that we necessarily have to directly feel it, but I personally find it helpful to remember that everything is changing, even at the cellular level. So I think really it's just like a thought experiment. And I think a lot of our practice really is a thought experiment. Anything else on that, John?
Not on that, but... This might be a tough. Yesterday on the train, I had a sneeze and I remembered reading it and said, okay, there's going to be a gap. So I was gearing up for that sneeze. And in the beginning, before you sneeze, it's really it's hard to find there, find the gap. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I'll catch the one after. That's even harder.
Yeah.
Wow. That's hard.
Well, ironically, it's training. You're on the train. It's training. We're just an opportunity to become aware. But yeah, catching those gaps is, that's why we do the practice. That's why we take it as a practice, because it's not, it takes a while. I think it takes a while. But I think, I mean, you can, if you're looking for it, I guess you can catch your mind in this moment of just, like, there's no conceptuality just for this blink. Something startles you, or you sneeze, or whatever, you know, whatever else happens. So many things. I read somewhere, and I don't remember if it was in this book or if it was somewhere else at this point, that there are so many things in our experience of a day where our conceptuality actually stops. Something absorbs our attention to the extent that it stops our mind for just a second. I mean, like a beautiful sunset, for example, something like that. Like, your mind really stops because you're absorbed, and it creates a gap. At least that's how I feel about my experience of such things. So thanks, John. Jinsung, you're unmuted.
Okay. So I actually, this is very curious to me, this notion of change, because I noticed that two things. One is, if I actually get into that very, you know, uncommon, but when I get into the experience of staying present, then in that moment where I'm aware of being, like, remaining present, I don't have the thought of change, because in my mind, everything's in the past.
Right.
So I'm not thinking it's different than before. I'm just, it's a new moment. It's now. And I also noticed, as I was, like, watching my breath going in and out, it was a very strange thing. I also have what John was saying, this notion that, you know, I'm not aware of the cells. Sometimes I'll become aware of my heartbeat, mm-hmm. and yes. feeling the presence of the beating of the heart. But again, I'm not thinking inside turning, you know, taking in oxygen, outside CO2, the whole thing. But it was very interesting, because as I was watching my breath, like, I'm aware that there's change taking place in that very moment, you know, I'm doing something different. But at some level, there's still this idea that somehow I'm not feeling a huge, like, awareness of being hugely different in that sense of changing. You know, so I'm aware of the very, you know, the in the now. So I'm recognizing the movement and of, you know, through the breath, whichever direction and the thing and that. But to really, like, think about change, it's a very strange thing. I don't know if it's because at that moment I'm not doing too much conceptualizing. I'm just focusing on the breath. But somehow it doesn't get me closer. I mean, it's afterwards I can think about the change, but if not getting any closer, I can't explain it to that. That making me feel like in every moment, everything is changing.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I'm not sure. It's, I feel like it's sort of a stuckness somehow.
I think it's kind of a pointing out instruction in a way. Like, he's pointing us to something that's not really about cellular change or, you know, oxygen versus CO2. It's exactly what you said. If you're connecting with the now, that's what it's about, I think. Like, becoming aware of change is about connecting with the present moment, and that each present moment is a unique present moment.
It's a new just thing. Letting,
it's a new thing. It's a fresh thing, as they say.
Okay.
The freshness of every moment. So if you're there, then, you know, then you're already aware of change. The change is just happening naturally. I think the instruction is for those of us who maybe are more stuck in, like, this sort of fixed feeling of this is how things are right now, and we're not able to flow freely. Like, our awareness doesn't flow freely from one moment to the next moment to the next moment. And that's what tends to get us into trouble. So, like, that's just my take on it. It's, you know, again, it's like the reality we're being pointed toward cannot be captured in words, as he said in the previous section. And I think we're there. And those are great questions, because, yeah, I don't think we can really, unless you have some superhuman power, really feel change at the cellular level. But it helps me just to know that it's happening,
I guess. And then I see Dave's hand up, okay. But if I may continue, the thing is that, you know, although I say it when I'm meditating, I'm feeling it. It's, you know, then when I'm, like, off the cushion, so to speak, I'm well aware of being stuck and frozen, you know, in my, you know, anxiety over this or over that. And, oh, Sorry, that's my sister. Sorry.
A little Bardo.
Yeah, the Bardo of the... Okay. Okay, can you hear that? Because it's coming off, it's coming in my phone. Anyway,
we heard it, yeah.
Okay, sorry. All I'm saying is that I just wanted to say that unfortunately I'm not meditating enough to... It hasn't yet entered into my, you know, everyday experience that I can just like, I'm well aware of things being stuck when I'm not meditating.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the moment when you can go feet on the ground, space around, or you can go cellular change. You know, you can remind yourself everything's changing at the cellular level. So it unsticks you. Yeah. I think it's a method of unsticking us. So that's the best I got, but it's what helps me.
That helps. Okay, I will mute myself.
Okay. Okay, I'll unmute Dave. Got you, Dave?
For John's point, maybe, when I'm doing the meditations for the Vipassana with Mengyur Rinpoche, which is a lot of this is exactly, you know, how he does it.
So Dave, you're taking one of his other courses. Which course are you taking?
The Joy of Living Level 3, okay. The Vipassana Insight mm-hmm. course. And so with the cellular change and like going into the body, he does a few different things with that. But one of the key things is like the regression, like when you're grasping at, like you're grasping at your body. So then you look at the parts and then the parts have parts. And the parts have parts and parts. So then you get to the cellular level. And it's not like, I think it's exactly the case that because we can't perceive it, but yet we understand scientifically that it exists, that you're using those two things to point out the, you know, you're grasping onto this inherent reality that's not there. Because if it's a thing, then, well, it's a bunch of cells. And then each of the cells, well, it's a bunch of molecules. And then the molecules, well, it's a bunch of atoms. And each time with more and more space and movement. And so as you're doing this contemplation, like over a 15-minute period regressing down, you kind of really feel how grasping onto the solidity only to find that it's smaller parts with empty space, you get down to there's nothing but empty space. And he's like, but it's not nothingness. At that point, there is awareness of the emptiness of that space. So it's just another tool for doing that. But I think it was very helpful for me.
Yeah. Conceptuality is used a lot in Buddhism in pointing us towards non-conceptuality, like towards what's happening outside conceptuality. But yeah, that's a really good example. And I think it's very similar to what he's doing, pointing us to the cellular change. That's always going to be like a conceptual thing. And yet you can, through that, get to a deeper state of resting,
like
I think.
The contemplation process, like the analytical contemplation meditation. So you have the understanding and then you're just kind of dwelling with it for a long period of time. I think that's, you know, a big part of that practice.
Yeah. And he does some of that in this section of the book where he's deconstructing our sense of a fixed self and going through the whole, you know, is the self in the, you know, in the arm? Is it in the leg? Is it in the heart and lungs? Is it in the blood? And you can't find it and you can't perceive that directly, but it takes you somewhere. Yeah. I think that's helpful. Okay, thanks, Dave. Namdok, I'm unmuting you.
Lama, could you please tell me, I wasn't here for the first couple classes, could you tell me which, and I know it's in the information that you sent by computer, but could you tell me what book you're working from?
Mengyur Rinpoche, In Love with the World.
Thank you.
It's his new book, it's fabulous.
You get that through Amazon or?
Yeah, you can get it through Amazon, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Everybody I know who's read it has been completely blown away by it. And Pema Chodron says it's one of the most inspiring books she's ever read. Okay. Okay, anybody else have anything? I shall look at my list. So one of the things he talks about, actually, that I was quite taken by, because we spent some time in the KDC class, which some of you have dropped in on from time to time, on the 12 links. And he has a whole section on the wheel of existence. It looks like my note is for page 58, so I'm going to look there. But it's a theme that runs throughout the whole section, and it's what we were getting at when we studied the 12 links in detail. So page 58, he's been talking about the realms, and he's told that lovely story about the old monk when he was a child, the old monk who took him through the Mahakala room and the Wheel of Life, and was trying to scare him about the being reborn in the hell realms. And he just thinks, my father told me a long time ago that they're just psychological states, and he wanders away. So he says, and so he describes the Wheel of Life, and he says so on page 58, he says, the wheel signifies circularity, perpetuation, and suffering. Yet everybody knows the wheel, right? You know, in the middle, you've got the three poisons, and then outside that, and then you have a little thing about karma. The next ring is about karma going up or karma going down, and the next one is the six realms, and then you get the 12 links. It's like all of the things that go into, we'll just read him. The wheel signifies circularity, perpetuation, and suffering. Yet every moment provides a chance to wake up. Without becoming conscious of why we behave the way we do, the patterns that keep us spinning in samsara are reinforced by recurrent behavior. So all of those circles, we just go round and around and around. All of those circles propelled by habit. And when you go through the 12 links, that becomes very clear, like step by step, how your habitual patterns work and how they always end in the same place, which is suffering. So he says, all right, activities today tend to conform ideas of who we think we were yesterday. And this perpetuates the very behavior that limits our capacity for change and transforms our tendencies into patterns that feel immutable. This is the nature of karma. Aspects of our past are carried forth into each new moment. And if you remember the 12 links, the first link is ignorance, and then the second one is karmic patterns kicking in. Karmic impulses, your karma from the last lifetime, or your karma from the last time you went into this addiction cycle or whatever it is, or the karma from the last moment. You know, whatever solidified in the last moment reappears in the next moment. So aspects of our past are carried forth into each new moment, and then it unfolds from there based on the previous habit. At the same time, each new moment also provides a chance to relate to old patterns in new ways. If we do not take advantage of these opportunities, then there is nothing to interrupt the inherited karma of negative mind states. Then we really are stuck. You know, it's still, we're only stuck in our own mind, but we feel stuck. We're stuck in our habitual reactivity. So he says, we inherently have free will, yet this only arises from an examined mind. Because if the mind is not examined, you're just going to keep going round and round the hamster wheel again and again and again. So to activate your free will, you have to notice the gaps. So he says, our future is influenced but not determined or destined by past conditioning. And again, this can apply to moment to moment to moment. We are not stuck in any moment, but we have to become aware that we're not stuck. We have to become aware that the nature of all of our experiences change, and that in those gaps, you know, every time we have a gap, which means where we can connect with our awareness instead of being stuck in the pattern, we have the opportunity to make a different choice. So he says, until we learn how to examine our minds and direct our behavior, our karmic tendencies will compel habits to reseed themselves. That's exactly what we see in the 12 links. So he says, he goes, going to the bottom of page 59, it is the mind's habit to experience the transition between realms or between breaths or thoughts. Oh, this is what, wait a minute, this is what we did for our meditation. Let's see if we have something else here, because there's a bunch of, okay, page 71, he continues this thought, and that's my last bit. So if somebody has something else to say, you'll have a chance in just a second. Oops, where does that start? the body scan. Okay, all right, page 71, I read this in the meditation. It's like the third paragraph. I needed to re-experience the continuity of change to remember that every moment holds a chance to transcend the fixed mind. Between every breath and every thought, gaps exist utterly free of conception and memory, but our mental habits obscure this information. So, for example, you know, I was talking and he was talking about notice if our experience is pleasant or unpleasant. And that's okay. That's like step seven. That's link number seven. Like all of our karmic patterns have kicked into form where we are right now. And so when we have an experience, when we come into contact with something in our experience, the next step, the seventh link, is feeling pleasant or unpleasant. And so if we can just stay there in awareness that this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, it's going to pass anyway. Like that's our gap. It's going to change anyway. So if we can just wait it out at that level of pleasant, unpleasant, then we don't have to create anymore. We don't have to reinforce our karmic patterns. So the next one, we don't have to go forward into craving, which by craving means attachment or attraction and aversion. Like you can feel that coming, attraction, aversion. I want more of this. I don't want this. We could just go back when that kicks in, we could go back. And I'm not saying that I succeed at this, but theoretically, this is what we can do. And we might get it every once in a while, is we feel the attraction or the aversion and we can go back to, I'm just going to rest in pleasant, unpleasant. And before you know it, your mind's on to something else anyway. You know, but even if you're in, and I know I've said this before, even if you're in, you get a little stuck in attraction and aversion, when you feel yourself in grasping, which is like going for it, like pushing something away or going to get, you know, to get what you want, you could stop there. Like there's gaps between all of these links. You could stop at any of them. And if you can stop at any of them up through grasping, then you're not going to act. And you're not going to reinforce that pattern. And that's where I always try to go back to, is pleasant, unpleasant. Just rest with the sensation. So anyway, that theme was just throughout the section, and I really enjoyed that. Yes, Jinzong. Oops, you'll have to unmute yourself.
I was going to just bring up two paragraphs that talk about something, but then I saw that also, and I think they have to do with what you're talking about, mm-hmm. but I saw also that Joanne had her hand up, so I didn't know if we wanted to give Joanne a chance first or if I should just go to my thing, whatever, whichever.
Why don't you go to your thing and then we'll pick up Joanne.
Okay, so on page 65, and the reason I'm bringing this up because again, it's talking about the bardos, this gap. But it's giving a different, and it's talking about the meaning of in between, because he also uses in between to describe gap. And so it's right after on page 65, a few lines down from where the italics end, and it starts, from the moment I left Tirgar, so if everyone's there, from the moment I left Tirgar, I was in between in a literal way. Even on entering the train and getting a seat, I was in between, as I was still now circling the station. Yet the true meaning of in between has nothing to do with physical references, but is about the anxiety of dislocation, of having left behind a mental zone of comfort and not yet having arrived anywhere that restores the case, that restores that ease. In the literal description of the bardos, in between describes an insubstantial, non-material state of being that is in the process of seeking to return to substance. It seeks to resolidify and to once again become somebody. From within our material forms, we already know that generally the experience of ourselves as no thing and no body is simply unbearable. We humans actually cannot stand this possibility until we wake up and realize that this transient and fluid state is our true home. Yet we are always in a state of not knowing and of uncertainty. That's the nature of existence. As a daily life experience, the bardo of becoming expresses a heightened state of displacement, of falling apart, of not knowing what's happening. These are the underlying conditions of these times when we experience certainty and when we do not ever really change. The shift comes from our perceptions.
Yeah, I had that marked too, yeah.
It didn't exactly follow yours, but you know, again, this reason why the ability to stay with the gap is it's so disoriented, and that what's so ironic is that what we feel comfortable with is returning to the delusion that makes us, you know, something that makes us feel safe, which, you know, that thing of staying in the gap, like why do we keep going right back to what we're comfortable with, which is our way of thinking, you know, our habitual way of thinking.
And he points out in his experience that even the things that felt like a refuge or a safe place at first turned into something that wasn't safe. Oh, I'm on the train. Finally, I'm on the train. And then the train turns into a hell realm. Yeah. But I thought that the key point here was that sentence. These are the underlying conditions of those times when we experience certainty. Like even when we feel certain, even when we feel safe, we're not. So what we're trying to do here is use the gaps, use those, like, be comfortable, learn to be comfortable in those gaps, in those transitions, in those sort of unsettled, disoriented states, because that's the reality of all of our experience anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm going to see what Joanne has to say. Joanne?
Yes. Can you hear me, Lama?
Yes. Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Good to see you.
All right. As you know, I'm in a great state of transition right now. Yeah. However,
You've just moved, right?
But at the same time, I sustained my practice. But again, I wanted to interject that those moments of aversion and attachment, that quest for equanimity brings to mind the fourth immeasurable, that I, of course, it's part of my daily practice, but again, it becomes part of you. And that's most important, is that let me remain in the state of equanimity, free of attachment and aversion that holds some close and others distant. Yeah. And then I try to bring in the Heart Sutra and, of course, the diamond, the Sutra of, you had mentioned it in a very early lesson when I wasn't on board of the 37 practices, but I did avail myself and read it. So again, that aspect of emptiness and developing fearlessness, that's the key, fearlessness.
Yeah, and that's what we do. We try to be comfortable in those places where we're actually really uncomfortable. That's like a really fruitful practice. Yes, Deidre, I'm unmuting you.
Probably most of us women our age, we've gone through menopause and had some kind of experience that goes along with it. And fortunately, one time I used to get these hot flashes, but right before the hot flash, it was like somebody pulled the rug right out from under my feet, just like they do those tablecloth tricks. So pretty much all of reality as I know it would disappear in an instant.
Wow.
And kind of leave me hanging. So I had, and it would happen right before I would go to sleep. So I had a chance to kind of be almost asleep and then have that happen and then kind of stay in that space. And I felt so fortunate that I was a practitioner, because otherwise I think I would have really been scared. I think it would have been very unsettling. But because I had some tools, I was able to cope with it. The other thing was in meditation, I was meditating once and I actually saw a hot flash coming before I got it. And it was just like an elephant just thundering down a road, pounding. I couldn't believe the energy of it. And to just sit there with it was just amazing. Not, trying to get away, not trying to analyze it, but just really, wow, watching it and seeing how powerful it was. So I think when you can't feel the cells, maybe, but there's certainly enough going on in a menopausal body to look at.
And I'm sure you guys have had some kind of equivalent experiences in your lives.
Right, right. Everybody must. At some point.
Yeah.
But I just thought I'd share that.
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, I think it's very much the same thing that we're talking about. Yeah, you got some pretty obvious transitions or gaps. Yeah. That reminds me too of another passage that I marked that I was really struck by. It's on page 76 and it's short. Talking about how we can have glimpses of the gap or glimpses of emptiness, but if we're not practitioners, our mind isn't prepared, it can be very disorienting or even upsetting. And he gives this example. An American friend described a day at the beach when she was a teenager. Summertime, relaxing with friends, suddenly she disappeared. Everything was there, the friends, the beach, the water, and everything was shimmering and brilliant. I could see, I could hear, but I was not there. This lasted for 2 minutes at most, and she offered that she had never taken hallucinogenic drugs. She did not say a word about it to her friends. The experience became an inexplicable shame shared with no one. She thought that maybe she had literally lost her mind, that this event might indicate insanity. But then she told him decades later that when she mentioned this to friends who had also found their way to meditation, many of them reported similar moments of spontaneous glimpses, as well as the fear of revealing. So, I mean, I can certainly relate to that. Like, I can think back to times in my life when I had that kind of a glimpse, that kind of, I mean, what she's describing there is a non-dual awareness. So she was like plunged right into nature of mind, a nature of mind experience without the tools to recognize what she was seeing. So anyway, I thought that was something. I wondered if other people had, if that had resonated with other people and if they had had similar experiences. Angela, I'm going to unmute you.
I was T-boned in the middle of Atlanta and I knew I was going to be hit and I had one of those experiences. I was like 18 and I just watched the car roll. I was calm. I did not come out with an injury. There was no reason. Wow. I just calmed from my head down to my toes and watched the accident happen. And I didn't have one thing wrong with me, even though it was a force of like 65 miles an hour and rolled the car. Wow. So no, I thought it was like my guardian angel had come down and saved me because I couldn't really explain why I would completely just calm completely. So it was really kind of like I was. And then I thought, oh, I was in that. I was actually where I'm supposed to be all the time. But you know. It was, Nyingma Rinpoche said that those kinds of experiences are great, but they're not very helpful unless you know.
Right. Yes, he does say that. Yeah, I've had those kind of experiences too in car accidents, but you know, I mean, it's like your mind goes somewhere else. I mean, you're just in some altered state of consciousness and you just watch everything happening, but I didn't come out with no injuries. I did not have the guardian angel, but I remember vividly like this almost slow motion effect of you see it coming and there's nothing you can do.
Your acceptance that allows that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. Maybe. So there, I wasn't resisting it. It's like, okay, this is happening. But anyway, thanks for sharing that, Angela. It's another kind of example of the same thing. I want to get on very soon to talking about dreams a little bit. Does anybody have anything else they'd like to share on this topic, on the book itself? Yeah, Jinzhang.
I just thought there was one other example that was really beautifully about on page 94 and 95, where he was talking about the grass rope and the ash rope.
Oh yeah, that is beautiful.
As, you know, a way to understand what healthy self means versus unhealthy self. So I don't want to take up too much time, but there were just two paragraphs that I thought were really nice. Would it be okay for me to read them?
Sure.
Okay. So, we're on page 94, and it's the very last sentence of the second to last paragraph where it says, Saljay Rinpoche has told me, you are here and you are not here, both, like the grass rope and the ash rope, same and different. Coils of grass rope found throughout India and Nepal are sometimes used for cooking fuel. As the coarse material burns up, the rope transforms into ash. The shape stays exactly the same, but it's empty of mass. Salje Rinpoche was comparing the grass rope to the self and the ash version to the mirror self. This mirror self is the fully functioning I, cleansed of selfish self, and this is a health self taking rent from its own city, which I think was denotinized by the habits of grasping. Mere, that's the misperception of an immutable self, and mere-ness becomes more like a hologram, a visible form that is not weighted down by habitual patterns of grasping and by the tendency to merge our identities with external phenomena. And then there's just one more paragraph, if that's okay. We all have the body parts, emotions, and perceptions that Nagasena listed, but Nagasena's point is that they do not add up to a cohesive, inherent me. Therefore, it's possible to function as the mere I, as one devoid of misconceptions about the self and liberated from erroneous views, especially from the misunderstanding that the compilation of parts adds up to something real and independent in its own right, not contingent on narratives and circumstances. We are all the self-inflicted victims of mistaken identity. When we confuse all the pieces for an essential, immutable me, then we surrender control to the ego, but we can learn how to make the ego work on our behalf in a healthy, constructive way. The mere I functions without attachment. It's not always engaged in manipulating the world for its own satisfaction. And that's where I'll stop. But I just
yeah, I think that's really helpful. I definitely have that marked too. And the mere I find that a really useful way. That's really useful terminology to me, the mere I. Okay, anybody else before we talk about dreams? So I'm just going to, I know that I think most people are taking the course. Not everybody is taking the course. So I'm just going to take a quick look at what we're doing here. So there's a chapter, actually chapter 13 in the book, the last chapter that we read for this section is on sleep and dreams. And he talks a little bit about practicing with those. The main practice that we were given in the Bardo of Dreams section of Dying Every Day is to work with lucid dreaming. And he gives us some techniques to do that, making aspirations, and then what you do if you actually find yourself in a lucid dream. I mean, this is pretty esoteric stuff. We got this in 3-year retreat. And it's, you know, you don't, I mean, there are books on dream yoga. It's being shared more now, but this is a pretty deep practice. We're supposed to practice with our dreams at night in that way. And then in the daytime, and I think this, whether you're taking the course or not, and getting the techniques or not, this is something we can all do to bring this practice into our lives, which is the daily life practice exercise. At least 3 times a day, apply the dream practice in daily life. Remember to wake up from your thoughts or whatever story you are in and see life as a dream. I find that really useful to go through the day and every once in a while, or sitting in my practice, like doing my practice, what's the difference between what I'm experiencing now and what I would experience if it were a dream? How is it different? Could it be a dream? And see its empty, ephemeral, fleeting quality. Again, tuning into the impermanence of our experience. And also to choose one area or situation in your life that is challenging or scary. Notice the grasping in the mind and try to change your attitude so you see the situation as an opportunity to learn or even an adventure. So those are the basic practices. And then especially in chapter 13, he talks about an alternative practice, not about lucid dreaming, but about working with awareness. he starts out on this page 111. He starts his sleep meditation with a head-to-toe body scan. And then he places his mind lightly on the dissolution of the senses as they begin to fade, seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling, and so forth. So he says, the observation that he makes is that every night when we go to sleep, we go through the same kind of dissolution as we're going to go through on a larger, more definitive scale in the process of dying. And so we can work with that. We can prepare ourselves for dying by doing the sleep practice of just staying in tune with our awareness. And so over time, you might more and more start to notice the stages of falling asleep. So I just wondered if anybody had had any particular observations about their experience with any of these practices or anything about the dream practice that you want to talk about while we're here. We got another 15 minutes. Jinzhang. I'm not able to unmute you for some reason. You're still muted.
Okay. So I'm not going to discuss any of my personal experience. I just wanted to share that there was something that really made me chuckle, if I might, on page 113, where it's at the second paragraph before you get that gap on the page on 113.
Okay.
And it says, for me, the best time to practice sleep meditation is still during a meditation session when I get very sleepy and allow myself to fall asleep, or during one of those indescribably long, boring ceremonies. I just thought, wow, that's funny, number one. And number two, when you're really bored or in whatever situation where you're just really losing it, like, watch your mind in that moment, because that's akin to, the transition of, totally lose, going to sleep or whatever. So I just thought that one, I actually made a little happy face by it.
Yes, so. Yes. I think Lama Narla Rinpoche did a lot of that kind of practice.
it's true. He would just set us up in meditation and then he'd fall asleep and then we'd all be sort of waiting open, and Jandren would look at him, whatever. But if I knew now what, I know now.
And he'd wake up and say, good sleep. But actually, one of the things, and I saw your hand, Marilyn, so you're next. One of the things that most resonates with me in this book is just Mingyur Rinpoche's honesty about how hard some of this practice has been for him during the retreat and even, in his life. And the lead up to that funny line is that he always had trouble staying aware, maintaining awareness when he was falling asleep. And then one day he couldn't stay awake in a meditation session or a teaching or something. It was a meditation session. And so he gave himself permission to just practice sleep meditation. And it was like the best sleep meditation. He had a breakthrough doing it in that situation. So Marilyn, go ahead. Sorry, I had to wait.
This is not mind shattering, but I didn't sleep very well last night. And this is a napish time for me of the day. And so I was falling asleep when you were leading us through meditation and trying really hard to be aware of what I was doing, and it didn't work.
Oh, did you fall asleep?
Not well, I was near nodding off stage.
Well, the thing is just to maintain awareness, whatever is happening. So if you have to go to sleep, I mean, that you get permission right here from Mingyur Rinpoche. Like, if you can't stop yourself from falling asleep, if you're that sleepy, make that your meditation. You might miss something, but we're always going to miss something. Yes, Angela.
I was on retreat, and he did us through the sleep meditation, so it was part of our homework, and I kept, and he said, have a mustard seed at your throat so that will help you spawn off more dreams. And I woke up every night screaming, I'm dreaming. And it was good when I listened to Miyoshi saying, okay, you also need the aspiration that once you discover you're awake in the dream, not to stay to sleep, to stay in the dream. So I think that was very helpful. I still haven't had that experience again, but that was the whole
thing.
It was just like that, me waking up and screaming that, and I'm sorry for my neighbors.
Well, we get a sense of some of the obstacles or difficulties or stages of sleep and dream practice, from the readings and from the webinar. Yeah, and Mingyur Rinpoche, just, you know, for the record, and Jinzong and I had different reactions to this, but Mingyur Rinpoche says, you sort of, if you have a lucid dream, like a real lucid dream, seven times in your life, then you're good for the bardo of dharmata. So it's not like we have to be lucid dreaming all the time, like once we start the practice. It's like through doing the practice, it will hopefully happen from time to time. Anybody else? Yeah, Dave?
I just wanted to ask if anybody else who has more experience with dream meditation also uses meds. Because I noticed, like, on the various psych meds I've had for bipolar depression, it seemed to cut off my dreaming, right? But so really it was like just the awareness of dreams. Mm-hmm. And I've backed off meds lately and just working with it, I've been able to do a little more stuff. But I just want to know if anybody else has worked around that or heard of it.
Jinsung, I'm going to let you unmute yourself.
Firstly, I would say don't back off. If medication is helping you, Lamanor Larimpiche always said take meds.
Yeah. I'm not backing off of meds for that.
Right. But one thing I think that's very important to, the important thing about this is that it's creating that habit during the day to just be aware, you know, and that if you create the habit during the day to be aware, you know, to rest in awareness, then that's what will awaken in the dream state, and that because it's become the habit. And so that's what's most vital. If at the time you're not finding, you know, because that's also what Myoshin was, you know, let go of any expectations. And so and I was speaking at one point where I said, you know, I recognize when I'm dreaming, but do I know that I'm actually dreaming? I mean, in other words, if I'm aware I'm dreaming, I usually wake up. So that right way, it's that thing of how do you stay asleep to then go further in the dream. But secondly, it's one thing to know you're dreaming, but are you still being tossed around by your emotions and thinking that the dream is real? Mm-hmm. Because you haven't yet gotten used to this, you know, if in our day, like that's the most important time to practice in a certain way is like during the day to establish that habit of, wait a second, is this actually real? Because no matter how much you might recognize a dream, it's unlikely that you'll progress if you haven't at some level worked during the day. So, you know, I wouldn't in any way worry about have expectations and think that in any way your drug regimen, you know, whatever it's doing, that's who you are right now.
Right.
And just leave it with that. Don't see that as an obstacle.
Yeah, he gave us a couple of different methods, and one is to work with dreams and one is to just work with awareness. And I personally work more with awareness. I'm too lazy to work with my dreams that much. Mark, do you have anything to say? Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a couple of thoughts, maybe not necessary at all, but like the Tibetan word for meditation is gom, right? Mm-hmm. And which really means familiarization. So what you're really trying to do is familiarize yourself with how your mind is or how it works. And there's a passage here on 114, it says, which I definitely agree with, it says, dreams can reveal useful psychological information that cannot always be accessed with our daytime minds. But when we use dreams to investigate reality or investigate our minds, we do not try to interpret or understand their meaning or look for signs and symbols. We just work with direct experience, that with the direct experience that dreaming offers us. So I think that's really great, you know, that he says that here.
Yeah.
I think that's really... Well, that's really all I want to say.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Familiarizing yourself with that part of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just another way to connect with awareness.
Mirror self. I guess you're more mirror when you're dreaming, right?
You're more mirror. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what he says, is that we're not as fixed. Our identity is not fixed when we're in the dream state, which was what makes it so interesting and so possible to work with it, because we're so much more like flexible. We could become an animal, or we could, right, you know, fly in the sky or whatever. We can't do those things now because our identity is very fixed in the solid form. But again, I think that's a really good point, that they're all just methods of cultivating awareness. And so working with dreams and working with sleep are just more opportunities to do that. And I wanted to read, and I saw your hand go up again, Dave. I just wanted to read this. I found this very helpful in Andrew Holacek's article that was part of our reading in the course. He says, we're non-lucid to the contents of our mind at night, to the extent that we're non-lucid to the contents of our mind during the day. This is like Jinzong's point. Become lucid to your thoughts during the day by practicing mindfulness meditation, and you'll naturally become lucid to your dreams at night eventually. I think, Dave, you had something else to say?
No.
Okay. Okay, anybody else before I call on Lama Jinzong? Anybody else had anything? Okay, I'm going to let you unmute yourself, Lama Jinzong.
I just wanted to say that an important point of dream meditation is simply to be able to, since we sleep so much of our life, is simply another way to make use of our life to continue practicing, just like you said, Jidren, you hit it on the nail. It's like, you know, it's we're trying to work with our awareness. And so dreams are, you know, it's one thing to say, well, if you can seven times and fabulous, you'll be able to, you know, liberate yourself during the bardo of the dharmata. But the point is also, it's a way to not waste time. You could actually use the time falling asleep or the time where you're just waking up, irregardless if you're able to work within your dreams. It's just attempting to make use of more time that you would normally think, well, I'm not meditating now. I'm going to go off to sleep. And then when I'm first waking up, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah. Anybody else? John, I'm going to let you unmute yourself.
So I started doing this before I even knew what it was. I mean, I heard it. So I said, let me try this. It was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I could watch myself go to sleep, and I could also see that I wasn't dreaming at points. So some nights I didn't dream, but I was aware that I wasn't dreaming.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. But and then I've had an experience, I guess. But I would take power naps working at Domino's Pizza. I'd go in the office, put my head on the desk, try to take a power nap, and I was still aware, so I could hear the phones constantly ringing, and at the same time, I was as if I was working. I guess, I don't know if I was dreaming, imagining what, and I was routing my drivers, you know, getting them out the door and telling them where to go and hearing when they would come back, which was one of the skills you develop to know when they're supposed to be coming back from their delivery. And so that was all happening. So it was kind of like, wow. Then I had to wonder, well, were any of these runs or deliveries I was thinking of true? So I kind of looked at the sheet, and a few of them were. So I don't know what that, I guess that doesn't mean anything, but it was just weird.
Yeah. Yes.
That was it.
The flow of experience carried into something like a dream state or an altered state of consciousness, an almost sleep state.
Let me throw one more thing out there, because practicing with that awareness at, you know, all the time, even when I wasn't, you know, when I was supposed to be sleeping or not, when I was in a coma, I could hear every single thing that happened. And I was in a coma for over a month, and I heard everything and imagined it in my mind as it was happening. So I attribute it because I was, you know, because of the practice. So I don't know if that's helpful to anybody, but it worked. That's how it worked for me.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me that there's some extracurricular reading. If anybody is looking for anything else to read, this is a fabulous book. John's nodding his head. My Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor. If you're not familiar with it, it's a very short book. And there's also a TED talk by her that you can find on YouTube. That's really good. And she's was a neuroanatomist. She studied brain anatomy, and in her late 30s or early 40s, she had her stroke, and she was like aware. through that process. And she, after she recovered, which took like 5 or 8 years or 12 years or something like that, many years, she was able, with some, you know, help, she was able to reconstruct like the experience of actually going through the stroke. And it actually resonates a lot, as someone said, with our practice, our observations about having a stroke and, you know, being in a state where, yeah, people sort of assumed that she wasn't aware, and she was aware. She was hyper aware of everything through this whole experience. Anyway, it's a really great book. Jinzhang, you're going to have to unmute yourself. Sorry.
I see that. So, John, I'm really interested in what you were saying about that you were aware that you weren't dreaming, because that's one of the, you know, the notion of these practices during deep sleep, that it isn't like that you can actually, you maintain awareness even if there's nothing seemingly happening, that you're aware that there's nothing happening, that you're aware that you're in a dream, that you're in a sleep state, but that you're not dreaming. So that this is this whole idea of how the great yogins maintain awareness like 24/7, you know, no matter what state of mind they're in. So that's pretty amazing that you actually have that experience. That's all.
Okay, we have like a minute left. Does anybody who hasn't said anything yet have anything that they would like to say before we do our prayers? Or anybody who has said something before, you got anything else you want to share? Okay, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I have a question, just in terms of, what do you call it, bookkeeping?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
So, logistics.
Logistics. Yeah. So the next class is next Thursday. Mm-hmm. I don't know what date it is. I'm quickly going to my calendar. So I'm assuming then that the next class will be on, since I'm going to be leading that one, that will be on the next chapter, the meditation, Bardo of meditation. Is that correct? So we'll have to, you know, I'll try to have all of it, you know, read by then. But I mean, is that what it
is? Is everybody ready to move on to the next set of readings, which are pages 117 to 147. It's a much shorter section.
Okay, that's only 30 pages.
The Bardo of Meditation. So yeah, because we can spend another week going, you know, talking about sleep and dreams and so forth. I'm personally probably ready to move on, but I'm also fine continuing. Anybody have any?
I think it's interesting that that if you look at the next page, 139, after the next, like you're saying, it's only 30 pages, which mm-hmm. that's due, not even actually, 116 to 138, did you say?
No, 117 to 147.
Oh, 147, never mind. Well, it turns out there's some chapter in there that's called, you know, what is your happy dream? So maybe that will relate a little bit to dreaming.
They're going to overlap.
Okay.
As he says in the book about our bardos, they're not discrete. You know, it's not that you're in this and then there's a gap and then you're in the next thing. It's like there's an overlap between everything. There's still gaps everywhere, but, you know, it's not all cut and dried, not completely linear. Okay, so I guess we will go on to then the Bardo of Meditation and pages 117 to 147 in the book for next time. Okay, anybody have any other comments before we do the prayer? Okay, I'm going to make sure everybody's muted and we'll do our dedication of merit, letting our minds come to rest again, being aware that we have now ended the Bardo of Thursday class. We're going on to the next Bardo in our individual lives. Okay, I'm going to make sure everybody's muted. Okay. All right. Letting our minds come to rest once again. Becoming aware of all sentient beings in all the six realms of existence, all of whom are suffering in one way or another. And generating the wish that this practice, this study, contemplation, and meditation that we've engaged in may help them awaken may help us awaken and help them awaken. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. That would be the mere I. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. Just resting for another moment in the flow of our experience, whatever it may be. Pleasant or unpleasant, neutral, changing from moment to moment. Okay, everybody is unmuted. So we'll see you next week. Lama Jinsung will lead us next week, and we'll see everybody next week. Same time, same cyberspace.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Okay. If anybody is in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, please come to Sangha at KDC because the real live Lama Church is there.
As seen on TV. Yes, I'll be at KDC this Sunday, and we'll be Zooming as usual. I think most people are on that list in case they want to tune in. Same topic.
Same topic, Lama?
Yeah, same topic. Just more discussion, different group, or some of the same group, some different group. You know, we're discussing this book in all of my classes at present. So everybody's welcome to join us then. I will exercise my superpower and see you all soon. And see you, Marilyn and Patrick, Sunday.